Welcome to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast. My name is Cheryl, and this is my daughter.
Hi, I'm June.
Today we're covering part four of the Chandler allegations, and we'll bring to a close this first case against Michael Jackson.
You can find source material and reach out to us through our website, MichaelJacksonCaseForInnocence.com.
We'll be joined again by voice actor Paul Stefano to help us present our final chapter on the Chandlers.
In the Chandlers Part 2, we introduced journalist Victor Gutierrez and explained how District Attorney Tom Snedden and police were convinced of Michael Jackson's guilt before any real investigation began. We also discussed how the tabloids were offering a lot of money to anyone who had contact with Jackson. We laid out the steps the Chandlers took to pressure Jackson into settling, and we begin today's story right after the settlement in January 1994.
Michael Jackson's settlement with the Chandlers occurred on January 25, 1994. After the settlement, Evan's brother, Ray Chandler, immediately began shopping their book about the allegations. According to his own court documents, Chandler approached publisher Judith Regan in New York shortly after the settlement in 94. In 2009, Regan gave an interview in which she talks about her conversation with Ray after the settlement.
I asked Ray Chandler how he proposed to do this, given the fact that the Chandlers had actually signed a confidentiality agreement and taken $20 million, and he said that Jordan's father had given him all the information he needed for the book, and he believed he was outside the bounds of the confidentiality agreement because he would be the author. At the time, I had the impression that the Chandlers were brazen opportunists, and I found the entire proposal by the uncle to be distasteful. They enter a confidentiality agreement, and before the ink is even dry, they are shopping a deal that violates this agreement?
Ray Chandler won't publish his book until 2004, at the height of the media frenzy surrounding the second sex abuse case against Jackson.
From February through May 1994, District Attorneys Tom Snedden and Gil Garcetti take the case against Jackson to two grand juries, first in Santa Barbara and next in L.A.
On March 17th, Michael Jackson's mother, Katherine Jackson, is subpoenaed to testify before the grand jury in L.A. According to the press reports, prosecutors sought information from Katherine about whether Michael Jackson changed the appearance of his genitalia, as it did not match the description by Jordan Chandler. Michael Jackson's attorney, Howard Weitzman, responds to this unusual move by the prosecution.
In all the years of my experience, I've never before seen the mother of the target of an investigation called before the grand jury. It's just done in real poor taste. It borders on harassment.
Both grand juries fail to indict Jackson, which is notable. During grand jury proceedings, the jurors only hear the prosecutor's case. Because the defense is not present to contest the charges, grand juries almost always return an indictment. Research shows that prosecutors win grand jury indictments at an exceedingly high rate, between 95 and 99%. So it's a humiliation for Tom Snedden not to get a grand jury indictment against Jackson to pursue his criminal case. And instead of closing the case, Snedden uses his authority to keep the case open and continues to use taxpayer money in his search for other victims. Snedden's decision to hold not one but two grand juries has been described as excessive, given the lack of evidence versus the resources involved. Here's a quote from Mary Fisher's 1994 article, Was Michael Jackson Framed?
After millions of dollars were spent by prosecutors and police departments in two jurisdictions, and after two grand juries questioned close to 200 witnesses, including 30 children who knew Michael Jackson, not a single corroborating witness could be found.
In May of 94, Evan Chandler closes his Beverly Hills dental practice. In their divorce papers, Evan's second wife, Natalie, states that she got left with the tax bill on his dental practice, which was about $22,000.
In July of 94, Jordan Chandler informs the prosecutors that he is not willing to testify in a criminal trial against Jackson.
In September, Evan and his second wife legally separate, which is 8 months after the settlement date. As noted in the Chandler's book, after the settlement, Evan loses contact with his kids from a second marriage.
Also in September, the Mary Fisher article, Was Michael Jackson Framed?, is published in GQ magazine, which makes the case for Jackson's innocence. Ray Chandler, in his book, says this article sent Evan into a tailspin from which he never recovered. Evan had been completely obsessed with getting his version of the story out through his media contacts, and Mary Fisher's account runs completely against Evan's narrative.
On September 21, 1994, L.A. and Santa Barbara District Attorneys Gil Garcetti and Tom Snedden hold a press conference about the Michael Jackson investigation. They say they're not proceeding with a criminal case because the primary alleged victim had decided not to testify. Garcetti declares,
"Michael Jackson is presumed to be innocent, as any citizen in this room is, if they are not convicted with a crime. We are not charging Michael Jackson with a crime."
But their press announcement does not honor Garcetti's statement that Jackson should be presumed innocent. Here's a press report about this conference from the New York Times.
Tom Snedden, the district attorney in Santa Barbara, said more than 400 witnesses had been interviewed in the case and that two other possible victims had been identified. But he said one of these, who is now in therapy, had asked not to be involved in the case, and the other was out of the country and had made a general denial of wrongdoing by Mr. Jackson.
Based on these descriptors and based on who Snedden brings forward to testify in 2005, he's clearly referring to Jason Francia as the one who wished not to be involved, and to Brett Barnes as the one out of the country and denying wrongdoing. To me, Snedden is posturing at this press conference to save face about lacking the evidence to pursue a criminal case. He tries to use his authority and confident demeanor to make this statement about other possible victims sound incriminating, but I find it actually supports Jackson's innocence. What Snedden reveals is that out of 400 people interviewed, his only other possible victims are number one, someone who initially denied wrongdoing and only changed his story under coercive questioning, and no charges were ever filed. And number two, someone who has persistently and adamantly denied wrongdoing by Jackson. My takeaway from Snedden's press statement is that it's suspicious to base a case on one boy's allegations, which involved a coerced confession, and which were proven to have a financial incentive even before going public, versus the dozens of kids with the very same type of friendship with Jackson as the Chandlers, who say nothing suspicious ever happened and that Jackson is innocent. But Snedden doesn't offer any of the telling context about these other possible victims, preferring to leave a dark cloud of potential guilt to surround Michael Jackson's reputation. This press statement also makes it clear that the settlement with the Chandlers had nothing to do with the prosecutor's ability to file a criminal case. According to Jackson's FBI file, the prosecutors were still considering the criminal case 6 months after the settlement, and the Chandlers were legally free to testify against Jackson to potentially put him in jail, but they chose not to.
Snedden also states at this press conference that despite the prosecution's inability to charge Jackson with any crime, the investigation will remain open.
To give more of a background on why Tom Snedden was so aggressive and unrelenting in his pursuit of Jackson despite the lack of evidence, we're going to share excerpts from a New York Times article published in November 2003.
Early in his long career as a prosecutor, Thomas Snedden was so driven that he was often called Mad Dog, a nickname that was apparently both complimentary and damning. He was first given the moniker Mad Dog by other attorneys in his office for his tenacity. Even colleagues who admire his work have said Snedden often gets too emotionally invested in his cases.
Snedden's long history of becoming too emotionally invested in his cases I found relevant to his investigations of Michael Jackson, especially considering the lack of evidence.
In November 1994, five former Neverland employees file a $16 million lawsuit against Michael Jackson and other staff members. They allege harassment and threats by the new team of security guards brought in after the allegations went public. They also claim they were forced out for cooperating in the Chandler investigation.
This case is relevant to the Chandler allegations because two of these plaintiffs will testify against Jackson 10 years later in his criminal trial, claiming they witnessed improprieties towards Jordan Chandler.
One of these plaintiffs is Adrienne McManus, who I think is important to hear from because she was Jackson's personal maid from 1991 to 1994 and had access to his bedroom suite at all times. We explained in the previous episode how Adrienne McManus testified under oath that she never observed any inappropriate behavior by Jackson towards children. But her exculpatory testimony was before meeting with Victor Gutierrez, selling stories to the tabloids, and filing a lawsuit against Jackson. The other lawsuit plaintiff, later claiming to have witnessed abuse, is former security guard Ralph Chacon. We'll get to their specific allegations of molestation in later episodes, when we get to Jackson's criminal trial in 2005. What I want to present now is how their court case filed in 1994 undermines their credibility and provides evidence that we shouldn't trust their stories.
McManus, Chacon, and the other plaintiffs met with Victor Gutierrez before filing their claim in 1994 and later testified that he helps them with the tabloid stories they sold to pay their legal fees. Both Chacon and McManus were found in court to have stolen goods from Jackson, and each ordered to pay him about $30,000 in restitution. A fellow employee testified that McManus told her to lie and say she saw sexual harassment against McManus. Other witnesses from Neverland and outside Neverland testify against McManus to contradict her lawsuit claims.
When their lawsuit goes to trial in 1996, Chacon, McManus, and the other former employees are fined for lying in court, and their lawyer is fined for hiding evidence and concealing facts. The judge actually leaves the bench in disgust because of all the lying presented by these former employees. The jury rejects the lawsuit as fraudulent and awards Jackson damages and court costs, which the plaintiffs never pay. Although McManus and Chacon proved themselves to be unreliable witnesses, and their lawsuit was found to have been fraudulent, Tom Snedden is willing to use them anyway, and will bring them to testify against Jackson in 2005 with their stories of molestation.
In late 1994, former Neverland maid Blanca Francia and her son Jason threatened Jackson with a civil lawsuit over Jason's controversial claims of abuse. After just getting through the media nightmare of the Chandler allegations, and because he was on the brink of releasing his history album, Jackson, on advice from his attorneys, decided to settle to prevent more bad publicity.
Jackson included specific language in the settlement agreement, stating that both Blanca and Jason acknowledge that Jackson admits no wrongdoing to Jason and was settling only to avoid bad publicity, not because he committed any offense.
We know the wording of the settlement that Francia signed because it came out in evidence at Jackson's trial in 2005.
Before we move on to 1995, I want to mention that throughout 1994, Diane Diamond from Hard Copy receives letters from Rodney Allen. Allen will later be convicted of sex crimes against children. And in his letters to Diamond, he's posing as different young boys in Canada, writing about how they had been abused by Jackson. Diamond only later discovers that all the letters were from Allen. These letters will apply to a news story that comes up in April of 95.
On January 9th, Diane Diamond announces on LA's KABC morning radio show that police reopened their investigation against Jackson because of an alleged 27-minute videotape depicting acts of molestation and captured by a security camera from his LA condo.
We're going to share some of Diamond's statements from this radio interview. As you listen, take note of Diamond's confidence in the existence of this tape, based solely on information from her so-called best source. Here's Diamond's words on KABC Radio.
You know, just when you think the story is going away, it's not. The investigation is red hot again, and here's the deal. The top investigators within the district attorney's office are looking for a 27-minute videotape that they believe shows Michael Jackson and a young boy.
This is a recent video or something?
Yes, it was taken right before Christmas, as the story goes, and it was recorded by one of Michael Jackson's own security cameras. Everybody knows that he likes to bug rooms and put cameras up, and the whole nine yards.
How do they know about this?
Well, it's kind of a convoluted story, but the bottom line, as I understand it, is someone close to Michael Jackson knew of the existence of this tape. It is an X-rated tape, I must tell you.
It's an X-rated tape?
It is, yes.
Of Michael Jackson?
Truly explicit.
It's what? Are you 100% sure this tape exists?
I am as sure as I can possibly be.
You've not seen it?
I have not seen it, but one of my best sources on the Michael Jackson story has seen it.
who you have no doubts about.
I have never had a doubt about this person, ever. I know the district attorney's office is looking for it, because they are calling up reporters saying, "Have you seen it? Do you know where we can get it?"
Who had it and was showing it? His security people?
Well, someone close to Michael Jackson found this tape, and in deep concern for the boy involved, gave it to the boy's mother.
Uh-oh. Should Michael not know that one of his own security cameras was recording what he was doing?
Oh no, he knew. He absolutely knew.
It turns out that Victor Gutierrez is who Diamond refers to in this interview as her best source, who she claims she's never had a doubt about. And it's Victor Gutierrez who said, out of great concern for the boy, he handed this sex tape to the boy's mother. After the radio show, Jackson's lawyer sends letters to Hard Copy, saying police have not reactivated the case and that there is no video. But Hard Copy goes ahead and airs Diamond's story about the sex tape, featuring Victor Gutierrez giving comments about this very graphic footage. Here's Diamond, this time on Hard Copy.
Victor Gutierrez has reported on Michael Jackson for the last decade and has a book about to be published regarding the entertainer's relationship with various boys. Gutierrez has talked with this young boy's mother.
Police issue a statement after this Hard Copy show, contradicting the claims that they were investigating Jackson.
We have not reopened the investigation. We have heard about the alleged tape. We have not seen it, and we don't have it. Prosecutors were not involved in a search for such a video.
The only person who ever claims to have seen this tape is Gutierrez, similar to Gutierrez being the only one to see Jordan Chandler's alleged diary. Gutierrez says it's Jermaine Jackson's son and Michael Jackson's nephew Jeremy Jackson, who was molested on the tape. But Jeremy's mother, Margaret Maldonado, completely refutes Gutierrez. She describes what happened regarding this videotape in her book Jackson Family Values.
The story was an outrageous lie. Not one part of it was true. I'd never met the man. There was no tape. Michael never paid me for my silence. He had never molested Jeremy. Period.
My main takeaway from both the radio interview and the Hard Copy story is that Diamond is willing to air rumor as fact. She states without qualification that Gutierrez has talked with the boy's mother, when in fact Gutierrez's story about meeting the mother at the hotel does not check out. She states as fact that police are currently searching for the videotape, even though police had concluded the search 4 days earlier, and the police press spokesperson said they were not searching for a tape. She's only too eager to describe the salacious contents of this tape that she herself has never seen, and which never materializes.
On January 12th, 3 days after the Hard Copy show aired, Jackson sues Diane Diamond and Victor Gutierrez for slander over the story about the videotape. LA's Superior Court rules that Gutierrez's story is false, that Gutierrez knew it to be false, and therefore acted with malice and is liable for damages. An LA jury orders Gutierrez to pay Jackson $2.7 million, which he never does.
Ken Wells was a tabloid broker at the time, and after the sex tape story, he had a meeting with Victor Gutierrez about some work. Wells's statement is included in court documents related to Jackson's slander case. In this meeting, Wells questioned Gutierrez on whether he had or saw the alleged sex tape of Michael Jackson. And in response, Wells said Gutierrez smiled at him and said,
"Well, you know how that is. You know how these things are."
Wells believed Gutierrez was telling him, without saying so explicitly, that he'd lied about the existence of the tape.
Gutierrez also asked Wells for photos of Jackson, and that even if they were fake, he could make money off of them.
DA Tom Sneddon makes a declaration on behalf of Diamond in the lawsuit against her. In this declaration, he recalls that the investigation concluded after the Hard Copy story. Sneddon is going to bat for Diamond in this lawsuit. But the investigation was out of Sneddon's jurisdiction. His supposed recollection contradicts the LA investigator involved in the case, who closed the case 4 days before the Hard Copy broadcast.
Jackson's side was unable to prove malice on the part of Diane Diamond, and she escapes penalty with the help of DA Tom Sneddon. She was able to use the Shield Law, which allows her to place the burden of responsibility onto her best source, Victor Gutierrez.
I bring out the details here to show how Sneddon and Diamond have a mutually beneficial relationship, and they help each other out. Snedden even mentions in his declaration how he's spoken with Diamond numerous times since the Chandler allegations arose 3 years prior. Diamond's relationship with Snedden not only gives her access to inside information, but it also makes her attractive to even mainstream media when it comes to stories about Michael Jackson. Despite her history of airing rumor as fact, Diamond will later be widely used for commentary regarding Jackson's criminal trial, such as on NBC and Larry King Live. On April 27, 1995, 3 months after the sex tape story, Diane Diamond airs a hard copy episode about a Canadian boy who claims that he'd been molested by Michael Jackson.
According to Diamond, who flew to Canada to interview the boy, the 15-year-old says he met Jackson at a Canadian video arcade and then flew with him to visit Neverland. The boy gives Diamond detailed descriptions of Jackson's employees and draws accurate maps of both Neverland and Havenhurst.
Diamond says on her show that she finds it strange that the boy never appears with his adult friend, John Templeton, who was the boy's contact person for hard copy. Diamond brings the boy to Canadian authorities for questioning. The Canadian detective who handles the case says on hard copy,
"We took it very seriously and contacted the sheriff's department in Santa Barbara because that's where it allegedly happened."
While in custody, the child confesses that the allegation is a scam. He was coached in these stories by Rodney Allen, who is using the fictitious name John Templeton in his correspondence with hard copy. Rodney Allen is the person I mentioned earlier, who'd sent multiple letters to Diane Diamond posing as different kids writing about being child victims of Jackson. 4 years later, Rodney Allen is arrested and convicted of sex crimes against children. The Rodney Allen story is another example of how the media and police became so focused on Michael Jackson as their target that they missed a bigger picture. I wondered why Diamond didn't investigate how Rodney Allen got these details about Neverland in the first place. And why does Allen want to bring down Michael Jackson? These seem like the obvious questions a journalist should address after uncovering damaging false allegations against a celebrity. Knowing Evan Chandler's statement about paying a lot of people to be at the ready to destroy Jackson makes me wonder why Diamond didn't explore if there were ties to Evan Chandler or Victor Gutierrez, who befriended some of Jackson's staff. Is that how Allen got these accurate layouts of Neverland and accurate names and descriptions of employees working there? There's some evidence that Allen did have ties to Gutierrez and Chandler, which we won't go into here, but you can find out about through links on our website.
Although in this particular instance, Diamond's story is ultimately favorable to Jackson, she may have ulterior motives, since she is being sued by Jackson at the very time this story runs, and she needs to show a lack of malice towards Jackson.
The story also illustrates how a detailed accusation does not always mean the claim is more credible, but actually can be the result of extensive coaching, as Rodney Allen did with this boy, and as Evan and his lawyer appear to have done with Jordan Chandler.
In June 1995, Diane Sawyer interviews Michael Jackson and Lisa Marie Presley. During this interview, Jackson says he's completely innocent of any wrongdoing, and none of the evidence tied him to any molestation.
In response to Jackson's TV appearance, Tom Snedden gives an interview to Vanity Fair and makes incriminating statements about Jackson. He also says,
"The state of the investigation is in suspension until somebody comes forward."
Snedden's repeated targeting of Jackson in the media strikes me as unfounded and unjust. Even though in the Chandler case he had an unreliable confession, nothing found in multiple police raids, no body search match, and he failed to get indictments by two different grand juries, Snedden won't let go. And it reminds me of the nickname given to him by his colleagues, Mad Dog.
On November 12, 1995, Jordan Chandler legally emancipates from his parents. He applied for legal emancipation soon after the settlement in 1994. Jordan goes on to live with Evan's second ex-wife and his two younger siblings.
In 1996, Victor Gutierrez releases his book, Michael Jackson Was My Lover, The Secret Diary of Jordan Chandler.
On May 7, 1996, Evan Chandler files a civil lawsuit against Michael Jackson, Lisa Marie Presley, ABC Broadcasting, and others for breaching the confidentiality agreement of the 1994 settlement when Jackson declared his innocence in the Diane Sawyer interview. Evan Chandler demands $60 million from Jackson and a record deal so that he can release a music album about the alleged sexual molestation of his son. Jackson files a cross-complaint, which states that Chandler and his son breached the same contract by divulging information to Victor Gutierrez for his book.
Evan's lawsuit is dismissed in 2000.
On February 15, 2001, the New York Daily News quotes Tom Snedden once again saying the child abuse case against Michael Jackson has never been closed and that it can be reopened at any time.
In February 2003, Martin Bashir's Michael Jackson documentary airs in the U.S., which sparks great controversy and leads to the Arvizo allegations against Jackson a few months later. The release of this documentary caused a media frenzy surrounding Jackson's friendship with cancer survivor Gavin Arvizo, and suddenly, anyone with ties to Jackson is once again being sought by the media.
Also in 2003, J. Randy Taraborelli publishes an updated edition of his Jackson biography, The Magic, The Madness, The Whole Story. Taraborelli says Evan Chandler calls him after this publication and says,
"You owe me. If I ever see you again, it's not going to go well for you. You'd better hide because I am coming for you."
After Evan passes away in 2009, Taraborelli writes about Evan on his Facebook page.
"I met him several times in the 1990s. I had lots of secret meetings with Evan Chandler, trying to get to the bottom of what was going on. I was pretty young, sort of green, and wish I had my present level of expertise to be able to have applied back then. I have stories about Evan Chandler that I have never even published. He was about as inconsistent as they come. He was so determined to get me on his side, I thought he was just a tad scary. When my book came out, he called screaming at me for not just buying his story 100%. He actually threatened me, and I thought, okay, pal, now I know who you really are."
So this is another account of how Evan was actively reaching out to the media, conducting secret meetings to amplify his version of events. And the threatening tone Taraborelli recounts is consistent with the threatening tone on his recorded conversation with Dave Schwartz.
In September 2004, Ray Chandler finally self-publishes his book, All That Glitters. This release is timed to coincide with all the media hype surrounding the Arvizo allegations and Jackson's upcoming trial.
On September 19, 2004, Jackson's defense attempts to subpoena Ray Chandler because he's been claiming in his media interviews to have documents which prove Jackson's guilt. Jackson's defense team challenges him to come and show his documents in court, under oath, and under cross-examination.
Ray Chandler uses a lot of legal justification as to why he shouldn't testify, which is included on our source page. But basically, he refuses to go to court with his claims and is able to fight off the subpoena using the Shield Law that protects him as a journalist, even though his only journalistic work is this book. Raymond Chandler is unwilling to personally testify against Jackson, even after saying publicly that he has proof of Jackson's guilt.
On September 28, 2004, according to Jackson's FBI files, FBI agents meet with Jordan Chandler, who refuses to testify against Jackson, and advises the agents that he would legally fight any attempt to do so. Jordan also tells the agents that he had, quote-unquote, done his part.
I find this phrasing interesting. Because Jordan played no part in Snedden's criminal case back in 1994, he may be referring to his role in getting the settlement money for the Chandler family. Although we don't know Jordan's actual intent when he says, "I've done my part," it fits in with the larger evidence that Jordan had been coached by his lawyer to fill a particular role in Evan's plan.
After Jackson's trial in 2005, defense attorney Thomas Mesereau discloses that he had multiple witnesses ready to testify that Jordan privately told them that Jackson was not a child molester. Had Jordan decided to testify, Mesereau would have brought these witnesses to the stand.
Josephine Zoni was one of these four witnesses on the list, and she shares her experiences in the 2019 documentary Square One by Danny Wu, which covers the evidence in the Chandler allegations. I highly recommend watching this documentary to hear her account of how Jordan Chandler, who attended New York University alongside Zoni, allegedly told her that Michael Jackson was not capable of child molestation.
To date, Jordan has made no public statements about the allegations.
A month after Michael Jackson is acquitted in his criminal case, on July 24th, Evan Chandler files a lawsuit against his own son, Jordan, regarding money from the settlement.
A couple weeks after that, on August 5th, Jordan Chandler is granted a restraining order against his father. This restraining order describes the violence Evan committed against his son.
Evan Chandler struck Jordan on the head from behind with a 12.5-pound weight and then sprayed his eyes with mace or pepper spray and tried to choke him. The judge was satisfied that Jordan had provided evidence and determined that the weight could cause serious bodily injury or death.
In November 2009, 4 months after Michael Jackson's death, Evan Chandler commits suicide by shooting himself in the head in his New Jersey home. He did not leave a suicide note. Reportedly, he dies a lonely man, stricken with serious and painful diseases. Diane Diamond reports after his death that Evan Chandler had bipolar disorder and Gaucher disease that were both uncontrolled. In his will, Evan declared that none of his family members be advised of his death until well after his funeral. He also stated that he did not wish to leave anything to any of his 3 children.
For reasons best known between us, I purposefully make no provision in this, my last will and testament, for any of my children or their issue.
And that is the sad ending to our series on the Chandler allegations. In the 4 episodes that it's taken to present this case, we've given you a lot of information to digest. I want to take a little time to offer my analysis of all this evidence. So next time, we'll bring you a short episode to cover my conclusions about the Chandler case. Following this summary, we'll begin our series on the second sex abuse case against Jackson, the Arvizo allegations.
We'd like to thank the following websites for helping guide my mom's research: Turning the Tables on the Chandlers, The Michael Jackson Allegations, and Vindicating Michael. You can find all source material for this episode and reach out to us with any questions or comments through our website, MichaelJacksonCaseForInnocence.com, or on Twitter at Case4Innocence. Thank you for listening to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast.